I thought
Yeah.
to combine the Monday and Wednesday night shiurim and speak about Meshech Chachma and the Megillah. So I thought that would be something a little bit different. Certainly, we've never done that before.
Okay.
Are you giving a shiur on Wednesday?
Yeah. But the thing is, I've tried to stop the Parshas HaShavua. I put in a request with the chief rabbinate, you know, to see if we could take a break from the Parshas HaShavua 1 week in order to just, you know, have Megillah. And it apparently got rejected, but I'm still waiting to hear back.
So we don't have class.
No. Sorry. Wednesday night we'll be learning Meshech Chachma Parshas Vayikra, right? But I figured we could take Monday to learn Meshech Chachma and Megillas Esther.
Okay.
The Meshech Chachma Kedagba Kodesh, the Meshech Chachma has on Haftaras, Meshech Chacha has on Megillas. You name it, he wrote on it. So I want to share a couple of ideas that the Meshech Chachma shares with us with regard to the interpretation of Megillas Esther. He brings out a lot of other things in his typical style while explaining the Megillah, and hopefully we'll have some nice, interesting words, something a little bit different to share this coming Purim. First, let me just reiterate something I actually said this past Wednesday night, the Meshech Chachma shir, so I think two, three people heard it. But review never hurt anybody, and it happens to me. It's a beautiful idea. Exactly, right. So it's always good to review.
Absolutely.
So we find that there's a character, one of the relatively minor characters in the Megillah, by the name of Hasach. Hasach is the servant whom Esther sends out to Mordechai. Mordechai, after he hears of the decree of Haman, puts on sackcloth, he tears his garments, he puts ashes on his head, and he's sitting there in the Chatzar HaMelech, he's sitting there in the courtyard of the king, and Esther looks out the window, she's getting a little bit nervous, so she sends down Hasach, Lodas Mazeh V'Al Mazeh, basically to know what's going on. You know, what's Mordechai doing sitting there in such a state of affairs, right?
She knew nothing
at that point, right? So Chazal tells us this Hasach is quite an interesting person in his own right. This Hasach is none other than Daniel. Daniel of Sefer Daniel fame, of Lion's Den fame. Daniel, who at one time was the second in command to Nebuchadnezzar himself, right? Someone who occupied an incredible position in the Babylonian Empire, apparently now is serving as a servant, you know, as a gopher, a coffee boy, a Danish boy, going back and forth between Esther and Mordechai in a way which certainly was a demotion from his previous position. Chazal say, according to one opinion, that's exactly why he's called Hasach. Shechotchuhu migdulaso. The word Hasach is like the word chosach, which means to cut. So Daniel was cut down from his former position of prominence. He was demoted. You know, it was a new administration. Everybody gets shifted around. The Persians take over from the Babylonians. He used to be second in command. Now he's just going back and forth between Esther and Mordechai. And that's Daniel. Daniel shechatchu migdulaso. They cut him down from his previous prominence. We had last year Rabbi Yehuda Landy, who's a Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael, who came out last year with a book about the history of Purim. Very fascinating book. It's worthwhile to pick up. They have it in the Judaica stores. And he pointed out there's a midrashic tradition that Hasach was actually killed by Haman, and to this day, in the city which seems to have historically been Shushan in Persia, there is a kever which the local Jews have a tradition as the kever of Daniel. Right? They identify that kever as being the kever of Daniel / Hasach, you know, who was put to death by Haman according to one tradition in the Medrash. You know, that's brought. So this is Hasach. Hasach, who appears, it makes a cameo appearance, so to speak, in the Megillah, according to Chazal, is none other than Daniel. So again, we explained, Chotchu Migdulaso means he was cut down from his prominence in the Babylonian Empire, he was second in command. Now Nebuch in the Persian Empire, he's been demoted considerably. The Meshech Chachma has a different pshat, a beautiful pshat, as to why Daniel would be called Hasach. In what sense he was chatchu migdulaso, he was cut down from his previous prominence. Says the Meshech Chachma, the prominence of Daniel to which we refer deals not with his prominence in the secular world of government, but with his prominence in Klal Yisrael. Why was Daniel considered to be prominent in Klal Yisrael? So Daniel, as we know, was ready to put his life on the line for the practice of religion, for the practice of Torah. When Daryovish, the king of Persia, made a decree that for 30 days no one was allowed to pray to any deity other than the king himself, to Daryovish, Daniel openly defied the decree, as related in Sefer Daniel. He went upstairs, he opened up the windows to his house, he davened Shemoneh Esrei 3 times a day in full view of everybody. He says, I don't care, I don't follow such, you know, ridiculous laws. I'm going to follow the law of the Torah, which requires me to daven 3 times a day. They took him, they caught him, they threw him into the lion's den, and of course, miraculously, he was saved. After that incident, Daniel became identified by the Jewish people with the idea of Mesiras Nefesh, the idea of self-sacrifice, the readiness to give up one's own life, you know, Al Kiddush Hashem, for the sanctification of God's name. However, when Esther realized that Haman's plot was put into motion, as we know from the Megillah, Esther called together the Jewish people and said, you know, we all have to fast and daven and learn and beseech the Ribbono Shel Olam for 3 days, right? When the Jewish people did that, an act of tremendous Mesiras Nefesh, you know, to fast, a 72-hour fast, I mean, that's not a simple thing, right? They committed themselves to that because they, you know, they realized that this is what they had to do in order to avert the decree of Haman. All of a sudden, the entire Jewish people rose to the level of people who were willing to sacrifice their lives, Al Kiddush Hashem, for the sake of sanctifying God's name. In a certain sense, it brought Daniel down from his pedestal. Because whereas before, the people looked up at Daniel and said, wow, he's an incredible person, but none of us can really reach that level. All of a sudden, the entire Jewish people was transformed into a people that reached the level of Daniel. And chadchu migdulaso, they cut him down from his prominence. It's not meant as a put down to Daniel. The reason Daniel was, quote-unquote, cut down from his spiritual prominence was because the Jewish people were raised, and all of a sudden they saw, you know, it's not just Daniel who can be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. Every Jew has the ability to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim, to sanctify God's name on that level, and that was a tremendous, tremendous realization which ultimately brought about the Geula, which ultimately brought about the redemption, which, you know, that saved the Jewish people from the clutches of Haman. A fascinating pshat that Meshech Chachma gives in Chadchu Migdulaso to cut him down from his previous prominence. So let's talk a little bit more about that exchange between Esther and Hasach. Right? The Pasuk says in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Hei, Vatikra Esther laHasach misarisei HaMelech. Esther sees that Mordechai is sitting there in the courtyard. She calls in Hasach, one of the king's servants. Vatitzaveu al Mordechai. She sends out Hasach to go and speak to Mordechai. Lodaas mazeh vi'al mazeh. To try to understand mazeh vi'al mazeh. So the article translates, to learn what this was about and why. Right? But clearly it's a little bit of a funny phrase in the original Hebrew. L'das mazeh v'al mazeh, to know, it's repetitive, to know what this and what this, right? So what exactly is meant by l'das mazeh v'al mazeh? What exactly is meant in that double lashon, that seemingly repetitive idea which is put forward? So the Meshech Chachma, explaining this phrase, quotes a fascinating medrash from Chazal. The Medrash depicts Mordechai as going to Moshe Rabbeinu and trying to figure out whether the decree of Haman can be averted. So Moshe Rabbeinu says the following: Im betit hi chasuma, tfiloseinu nishmas, v'im bedam nechtema, masher hayahu. The question as to whether or not the decree of Haman can be averted depends on how the decree was signed in Shamayim. Was the decree signed or stamped in Shamayim with dam, with blood? Or was the decree in Shamayim signed or stamped with tit, with clay. If it was signed in blood, you can't undo it. If it was signed with tit, with clay, so then it can be undone. Right? The answer comes back, Omar le betit hi chasuma. Eliyahu HaNavi, who's consulted by Moshe Rabbeinu in this medrash, comes back and says, well, I took a peek. How did he take a peek? It's Eliyahu HaNavi, don't ask any kashas. Right? Eliyahu HaNavi goes and he takes a peek, and he says, I saw the document up in Shamayim, where the decree of Haman is signed. It's signed with clay. Oh, Omar le Moshe Rabbeinu, lech vodiyo le Mardechai. So says Moshe Rabbeinu, okay, so go and tell Mardechai that you can undo the decree. It's signed with tit. It's not signed with blood. What's going on over here? What does that mean? Right? to put it very, very simply, let's cut to the chase over here. What on earth is that talking about? It's signed with blood. It's signed with clay. Well, what's going on over here? Right? Just before we answer that question based on the Meshech Chachma, I just want to share this beautiful vort from the Vilna Gaon. And this vort from the Vilna Gaon is beautiful just in its own right. So ask the Meshech Chachma. Just go back for a second. They tell the Maisa as follows. Chaim Voloshin, of course, was the preeminent Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. So he was once sitting by his Purim Su'udah. And he made an offer by his Purim Su'udah. He was in a little bit of a festive mood. He says, you know, anyone who can tell me an original vort on the Megillah, I'll give him a dollar, whatever it happens to be. And Oni comes forward, says, okay, I'm interested in taking up the challenge. So let me ask you a question. You know this medrash from Chaim Voloshin, right? Where, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu is informed that the decree is signed with tit, with clay, and therefore it can be undone. Where do we find a hint in the Megillah to this idea? Chaim Voloshin says, good question. Where, Taka, do you find such an idea in the Megillah? So he said as follows. It says that Haman wrote, Asher Kosav al Hayehudim, he wrote a decree against the Jews, Le'abidam, to destroy them. Lamed Aleph Beis Dalid Mem. Said this Oni to Reb Chaim Voloshin, if you just break up the word Le'abidam into two words, you get Lo Bidam, not with blood. So from that word, you can see Asher Kosav al Hayehudim le'abidam, Asher Kosav al Hayehudim lo bidam. He wrote against the Jews, but it was lo bidam. It wasn't with blood. It was written with tit. It was written with clay, and therefore the possibility existed of it being undone. Reb Chaim Voloshin, the story goes, was just wowed by this pshat, and when he went later to his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, he told him over the pshat. He was very excited. And the Vilna Gaon said to him, the one who told you the pshat is the same one who told Moshe Rabbeinu the pshat. In other words, you know, that was Eliyahu HaNavi who came to you and told you where it was hinted at there in the Megillah. Right? So again, a fascinating little story and a little vort, you know, from the Vilna Gaon that relates to this idea of dam versus tit. Okay, good. So there's a hint in the Megillah for the idea that the decree was written in tit, in clay, and not in blood. What on earth does that mean? Okay, very nice. You know, but what's being talked about over here? Says the Meshech Chachma, we know Chazal tell us in Masechet Megillah that there were two sins which potentially brought about the decree of Haman. Right? According to one opinion, the Gemara in Megillah, the decree stems from the fact that the Jews, back in the time of Daniel, bowed down to the statue that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The Pasuk in Daniel tells us Nebuchadnezzar set up a gigantic statue, a golden statue, and he commanded that everyone from all around come and bow down to it. Except for Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who refused to bow down, the Jews came and they bowed down to that particular statue. Once the Jews bowed down to that statue, says one opinion, the Gemara and Megillah, they were, you know, the decree was sealed, and the decree of Haman was set into motion to punish the Jews for having participated in bowing down to that statue of Nebuchadnezzar. Another opinion in the Gemara and Megillah says, no, that wasn't it, right?
I think, wasn't it that they ate?
Oh, the other opinion says, no, The decree of Haman was sent against the Jews. Why? Because the Jews came and they participated in the Seud of Achashverosh. The Seud of Achashverosh was meant to commemorate the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Achashverosh said, it's been 70 years and the Beis HaMikdash hasn't been rebuilt. Obviously, it's not going to be rebuilt. So he made a party. The Jews came and they had a glatt kosher table where everything was under five different hashkachas. And the Jews came and they participated. Right? They didn't see anything wrong with it. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, oh, you participated in a party to celebrate the Churban HaBayis. That's it. I'm going to bring Haman against you.
Well, but you see, the first time they could have said they didn't have a choice. But this one, that they did have a choice.
We
so this really is the one that proves that right. The other one was also...
Right. And Mepharshim say right, like that. In other words, some Mepharshim say right. They're really both causes.
Right.
Right. The second one shows that, you know, when they were bowing down to the statue, that wasn't just because of coercion. Yeah. It was something deep inside them. That really was happy with the idea of bowing down to the statue.
But they weren't coerced to eat. It's
right.
That's
below,
correct. That's,
right.
That's the proof of the
pudding. Bashasio chados ein ones.
Ein ones.
Right, right. Yeah, so 100%. So that might, you know, solidify the idea that it's not because of coercion that they're doing this. It shows retroactively that they're bowing down to the statue was really something that they would have done even without coercion.
Yeah.
Meshech Chochma has a slightly different take on this thing. He says... Well, let's take a look at these two Averos. On the one hand, bowing down to the statue is collective Avodah Zarah. Now, that, by the way, is not so poshut at all. That's not so straightforward at all. There's an opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, which is quoted a few times in Shas. Rabbeinu Tam says that the statue Nebuchadnezzar built was not Avodah Zarah. Right? His intention was that it was a statue of Nebuchadnezzar. They didn't see it as a deity. Bowing down to the statue was a way of acknowledging Nebuchadnezzar's eternal reign. So what was wrong with that? Well, because the eternal reign of Nebuchadnezzar means Mashiach is never going to come. So in other words, it was a denial of the notion of Mashiach. It wasn't Avodah Zarah. That's the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. The Meshech Chochma is working with a different interpretation. The Meshech Chochma is assuming that the statue really is Avodah Zarah. And if the Jewish people bow down to the statue, so it means that they were collectively worshipping Avodah Zarah, that's a sin which... You know, you can't just wipe away, right? Ten Commandments, like the Egel Azov. I mean, it's like the golden calf all over again. That kind of sin, you can't just wipe away. On the other hand, the participation in the Seud of Achashverosh was a terrible thing. But at least there, perhaps that's forgivable. Because it's not Avodah Zarah. It's not even clear that it's an Isser. I mean, what was the Isser? Everything at the party was kosher, or at least the Jewish table at the party was kosher. Yes, it was wrong to participate in a Suda that celebrates the Churban HaBayis. I mean, no question about that. But, you know, Rabbi, show me in Shulchan Aruch where it says that you can't go to such a thing. Right.
And to drink wine, to go his
house. Well, but again, so the way Chazal portrayed it, Mordechai actually gave the Hashkocha on the party, at least the Jewish part of the party. Right, so I'm sure there were some people who wanted another Ashkacha also. That's the way that it works. But, at least, you know, Mordechai was giving Ashkacha on the party. He was making sure the meat was kosher, the wine was kosher, everything was kosher from a technical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it was Mavushal anyway. Right.
No.
Yeah. The wine that was served to the Jews was kosher at that particular point. Right. So in any case,
it's like a Christmas and New Year's party,
right, 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 right. Again,
they go there, they get kosher food, they
right, 100%. So it was wrong,
but they're participating.
But again, says the Meshech Chochma, maybe that's not as wrong as worshiping Avodah Zarah. Again, you know, find me the specific violation in Shulchan Aruch to participate in the Seud of Achashverosh. The Jews participated because they rationalized, okay, so what's the big deal? You know, it's not so terrible. So to speak, again, that's wrong, but I'm just saying it was a mistake that lends itself to correction much more easily than the mistake of Avodah Zarah bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. Says the Meshech Chochma, that's what the Medrash is talking about. Was the decree signed in blood? Or was it signed in clay? In other words, what sin is the sin that's responsible for this decree of Haman? Is it the sin of Avodah Zarah? If it's the sin of Avodah Zarah, so then the decree is sealed in blood. It's not going to be so easy to undo that. But if it's the sin of participating in the Seud of Achashverosh, that's sealed in clay, and they're already, you know, so maybe that can be undone with enough tshuva on the part of the Jewish people. So that's, says the Meshech Chochma, that's the pshat in Pasuk. She sends Hasach down to Mordechai, Loda'as Mazeh, V'al Mazeh. Was the decree because of Zeh, of this sin? Or was it because of Zeh, because of the other sin? What's the sin that caused this decree to come about? So in other words, how easily can it be wiped away, if at all? So what's our game plan? In other words, if it can't be wiped away, there's got to be one game plan. If it can be wiped away, there's going to be another game plan. So that's Lodas Mazeh fi Al Mazeh. Take it one step further, says the Meshech Chochma. The statue erected by Nebuchadnezzar, with regard to that statue, the Gemara asks the question, you know, Hanano, Mishael, and Azariah, you know, refused to bow down to the statue, and they were Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. What happened to Daniel? Daniel was alive at that time. Where was Daniel? You're going to tell me Daniel did bow down to the statue? That's a very disturbing thing. Can't imagine that. But on the other hand, it's only Hanano, Mishael, and Azariah who didn't bow down. So what happened to Daniel? So says the Gemara, Daniel ran away. Right? When Daniel got the word that they're going to make a statue, he checked out of there. He cashed it on his frequent flyer miles, and he went somewhere else. So says the Meshech Chochma, the truth is that's a little bit of a taina on Daniel. Right? Because had Daniel stayed and refused to bow, maybe the Jewish people would have refused to bow as a collective also. Daniel was on a greater level than Hanano, Mishael, Azariah. Their failure to bow, okay, people said, okay, they're very frum, you know, but the rest of us, we can bow down. Daniel had the kind of stature, where had he refused to bow, he might have influenced the rest of the Jewish people not to bow either. So in a sense, Daniel bears a certain amount of responsibility, says the Meshech Chochma, for the sin of the Jewish people bowing down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. At the same time, Mordechai maybe is a little complicit in the fact that the Jews participated in the Seuda of Achashverosh. As we just mentioned a moment ago, Mordechai gave Hashkocha by the Seuda of Achashverosh. And, you know, again, you can explain what was his perspective. He figured, look, if the Jews are going to go anyway, might as well make sure it's kosher. So, in other words, shouldn't be so bit, but maybe you could have argued the other way. If he would have stood on principle and said, I refuse to give hashkocha, if you're going to go, you're going to eat treif. So maybe that would have snapped the Jews out of it, and they would have said, okay, you know, we're willing to go and have a glatt kosher table at the party. We're not willing to go and eat tarfus at the party. Maybe Mordechai is a little complicit in that sin. Who's discussing at this point which sin is responsible, you know, for the decree of Haman? It's Mordechai and Hasach, who's Daniel. So says Esther, put the two major leaders of the Jewish people at the respective times of those sins together and have them figure out, Lodas Mazeh, V'al Mazeh, the two of you figure out which is the sin that's ultimately responsible for this decree of Haman, and then we can figure out a game plan together as to what the next step is going to be. So it all comes together, says the Meshech Chochma, Lodas Mazeh, V'al Mazeh, to know, you know, which of these sins is ultimately going to be responsible. A little bit further in the Meshech Chochma, let me just share with you one interesting thing which he quotes, Derech Agav. I don't want to get into how the Meshech Chochma utilizes this particular idea, because it'll bring us a little bit far afield, but he quotes a beautiful idea from a Tshuvas HaRashba, right? What's the discussion? It says in the pasuk that Hayom v'mei haPurim ho'eile lo yavu mitoch haYehudim v'zichrom lo yosuf mizarom. These days of Purim will never pass from the Jewish people, and they'll never be forgotten by their children going forward. Right? The days of Purim are forever and ever. There's a medrash in Mishle which makes the following statement. Says the medrash, Kol ha-moadim b'teilim, v'mei ha-purim lo yihiyu b'teilim. All of the other holidays are going to be nullified one day, but Purim is never going to be nullified. After all, it says in the Pasuk, v'mei ha-purim ho'ela lo yavu mitoch ha-yehudim. These days of Purim will never disappear, they'll never pass away from the Jewish people. The implication being, you know, Purim's never going to disappear, But Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, you know, even Tu B'Shvat, you know, all the other holidays, they're going to disappear. That seems to be the implication. Right? So says the Medrash. So the Rashba was asked the obvious question over here, just a word or two. The Rashba, Reb Shlomo Ben Aderes, was the Rav in Barcelona in the Middle Ages. He was a Talmud of the Ramban, Rav Moshe Ben Nachman, who wrote the famous commentary on the Chumash. The Rashba was well known as one of the great Rishonim, one of the great medieval authorities, wrote a commentary on most of Shas, and also was answering tshuvas, answering shailas, I should say, answering questions from literally around the world. I mean, at that time, Spain was still a major, major Jewish center, you know, before the Inquisition, you know, way before that time. This is basically during the 1200s and 1300s, you know, so you have at least another 200 years or so till the Inquisition. You know, so at that time, Spain, Barcelona in particular, was a seat of Jewish learning. The Rashba was fielding shailas from all over the world. And the shailas were not just about halachas. We'll see in this particular case, this is not a halachic question per se, but it's a hashkafic question. They wrote the Rashba and they asked him as follows. Mi hu shiyomar shiyavatel min hatara afilu os ech achas v'afilu kutso shol yud. How can you say that ka mo'adim b'teilim? How can you say that all of the holidays are going to be nullified? We don't believe that Torah is going to be nullified or done away with in any way. We don't believe that anything from the Torah is going to be nullified. There's another religion out there that says, you know, things from the Torah were nullified or going to be nullified. We've broken ranks with them a very, very long time ago, right? How can the Medrash say, okay, good, you want to say Purim's going to last forever, that's great, but how can you say that Pesach is going to disappear? You know, that Rosh Hashanah is going to disappear, that Yom Kippur is going to disappear? How could that be? So says the Rashba as follows. Nirale pirusha shekol hamoadim lo yiftiach aleihem yisporach ela yigrom hachet bitulam be'echad min hazmanim. When it comes to all of the other Yom Tovim, God doesn't make any promises about our ability to keep that Yom Tov. Meaning as follows, for sure the obligation to keep the Yom Tovim is an eternal obligation. No one ever suggests that there will come a time where we won't be obligated to keep Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. The obligation is going to last forever. Nothing from the Torah can ever be undone. However, it's possible that there will come a time where we will be unable, even as a nation, to keep one of the Yom Tovim for a particular period of time. The truth is, Pesach is a case in point. Because during the year that the story of the Megillah unfolds, right, so the Jews actually did not make a Seder that year. The 3 days of fasting that were commissioned by Esther took place over the first night of Pesach. They didn't make a Seder that year in Persia, indeed, in all of the 127 provinces. From time to time, says the Rashba, there may arise circumstances which force the Jews under those circumstances to not be able to keep a particular Yom Tov. It doesn't mean that the obligation is going to cease, but the wherewithal may, you know, temporarily be suspended. Klal Yisrael may find itself in a situation, Rachmana Litzlan, where, you know, as a nation, we're unable to keep Shavuos, we're unable to keep Rosh Hashanah. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't make any promises that we'll always be able to keep the Yom Tovim, with one exception. Kadosh Baruch Hu promises that we will always be able to keep Purim. There will never come a time where the Jewish nation as a whole will be prevented by external circumstances from keeping Purim. Avol b'mei Purim hivtiach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised that Purim is going to always be able to be kept by at least a portion of the Jewish people. It's a havtocha v'lo azhara. In the words of the Rashba, the promise of Purim is that there will never come a time where we will collectively be unable to keep Purim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu would never allow all of Klal Yisrael to not be able to keep Purim. That's the koach, the power that Purim has. Right? Again, not a Meshech Chochma per se, but a very interesting insight from the Rashba, you know, explaining this idea that Purim is never going to fall by the wayside. Okay, a couple of other ideas from the Meshech Chochma. Towards the end of the Megillah, Perek Tes, Perek Tes Pasuk Chav Dalet. We're told, Ki Haman ben Hamadasa ha Agagi, Haman, the son of Hamadasa from Agag, from Amalek, Sorer Kol HaYehudim, the enemy of all the Jews, Choshav Ala Yehudim LeAbedom. Right? He thought, he planned against the Jews to destroy them. Vehipil Pur Hu HaGoro, and he cast a lot, that is the the poor, lehumam ula abedam, to terrify them and to destroy them. So we're going to see the Mashiach Chachma is going to raise two issues in this pasuk. First of all, Haman is called Tsorer Kol HaYehudim, the enemy of all the Jews. What does the word all add? Tsorer HaYehudim, the enemy of the Jews. What, you thought he was the enemy of some Jews, but, other Jews he's friendly to? By the time you get up to Perek Tes and the Megillah, you've probably figured out, Haman didn't really like any Jews. It's not like not like he said, some of my best friends are Jewish or something like that, right? He was opposed to all the Jews, we know that. So why do you have to call him Sorer Kol HaYehudim, the enemy of all the Jews? And what's more, what's the double language at the end of the pasuk that he said he cast a lot against the Jewish people? Lehumam ula abdom, to terrify them and to destroy them. Between you and me, the destroying part is the much more malicious part. The fact that he was terrifying them, he was scaring them. He wasn't just scaring them, he wanted to kill them, right? That word lehumam seems rather extraneous. The fact that he was trying to terrify them pales in comparison to the fact that he was trying to kill them, right? That would be the more terrifying aspect of things. So the Mashiach Chachma writes as follows: Achas mi peulos hashkocha l'kiyum hados. One of the ways that divine providence ensures that we, the Jewish people, stay steadfast to our religion, he asher sinas ha'umos u'godol yoser be'ozvam hados. God put a psychology into the world such that the nations of the world hate us more when we abandon our religion. Right? By the way, there's a very famous Mashiach Chachma, Parshas B'chukosai, where he basically writes this very often quoted. Mashiach Chachma writes, if people think that Berlin is Yerushalayim, there are going to come some terrible storm winds which are going to, Rachmana Litzlan, uproot the Jewish people. Right, the Mashiach Chachma passed away in the 1920s. So, he wrote this far in advance of the Holocaust, and yet, he made this statement, which is really, far-reaching. If people think that Berlin is Yerushalayim, the storm winds will come and uproot the Jewish people. Right? It's a passage which is often quoted, probably one of the most famous passages in the Mashiach Chachma, where basically he's writing, there's this tremendous assimilation, it comes out of Germany, and Rachmana Litzlan, terrible things are going to come out of Germany also, right? Again, he died in the 1920s, about, 10 years plus before the Holocaust happened. So here, too, his insights into what's going on in the world and what's going to go on in the world are just very, very, poignant and uncanny. He writes, when is it that the greatest anti-Semitism rears its head? It's Davka when the Jews abandon Yiddishkeit. That's when they really hate us. As long as we're different, that we're doing our own thing, okay, they'll persecute us, but, we're not a threat. The minute we say we want to be exactly like you, they say, wait a minute, let's not take things too far over here, right? That's when anti-Semitism really becomes very, very strong. Davka, when we seek to abandon our religion, right? And he says, V'chein Haman, she'omar v'doseyem shonos, when Haman goes to Ahasuerus and says, could you give me free license to kill these people? He says, Vidoseyam Shonos, they have this different religion, right? So he mentions the idea, he hates their religion. But Etzem Sinoso Hoyo Lo'umo Gamba Ozvam Hados. Haman would have hated the Jews even had they abandoned their religion. Right, his hatred was for the Jewish people, not just for the Jewish religion as its own right. Right, in that sense, Haman is different than, let's say, an Antiochus. Antiochus says, look, you know, you want to abandon the Jewish religion and become Hellenist? Fine. You're great. Wonderful. Right? You know, Haman hates the Jews fundamentally, even when they abandon their religion. That, Lochein Omar ki Haman sorer kol ha-Yehudim. That says the Meshech Chachma, what's implied in this pasuk. Haman is the enemy of all the Jews, meaning all Jews, religious or non-religious, he doesn't care. He's just interested in being the enemy of the Jews. There are no good Jews and bad Jews. It's not like some people who have tried to assimilate throughout the generations think, well, you know, there are the religious Jews. That's the ones the anti-Semites don't like. But, you know, I look like the non-Jews. I dress like the non-Jews. I talk like the non-Jews. I was baptized like the non-Jews. I'm one of those good Jews. You know, they're not going to hate me. And comes the Meshech Chachma and says, you know, the derech of a Haman is that he's so rare, kol ha-Yehudim. He's the enemy of all the Jews. Don't fool yourself. From the perspective of this anti-Semite, there are no good Jews and bad Jews. He hates everybody equally. It has nothing to do with the religion. If, in fact, you have a Jewish great-grandmother that's... It's already enough, right? You know, it's hatred that's not mitigated by more religious, less religious. It's equal opportunity hatred. So rare, kol ha-Yehudim. He hates all the Jews. And that's the end of the pasuk as well. Hipil pur hu agara luhumam. He set about casting the lot luhumam to terrify them. He said, what's the meaning of to terrify them? Shiazvu hados. Right? First, Haman's plan was, let's terrify them into trying to get them to abandon Judaism. Right?
Luhumam sounds like to confuse them.
But in other words, to confuse them with terror. And actually, that fits in very well with his interpretation. Let's confuse them and get them to give up religion. And then, stage two, la'abdom, after they've given up their religion, let's, you know, come and destroy them now. Because now that they've given up their religion, now so comes Haman and says, well, you know, if you're not adhering to your religion anymore, so then I have every right, you know, to wipe you off the face of the earth because of your abandonment of the religion. It was a two-stage process. Luhumam, first to terrify them and to get them to give up the religion, and then la'abdam, to go after them in a physical sense for the physical destruction, right? So in other words, he hates them fundamentally. Whatever attempts he has to get them to give up their religion are ultimately just to lead in to their physical annihilation, their physical destruction. Another pasuk, a little bit later on in this last parak, right? We're told, parak tes, pasuk lamed. Vayishlach svarim, right? They sent letters, el kol ha-Yehudim, to all of the Jews, el sheva ve'esrim u'mea medino malchus ha-Chashverosh, to the 127 provinces of Achashverosh, divrei shalom ve'emes, with words of peace and truth, l'kayim es yimei ha-purim ho'ele bizmanehem, to uphold these days of Purim in their respective times. Right? So the phrase divrei shalom ve'emes, that he sent them words of peace and truth, it's a hard phrase to understand. What do you mean he sent them words of peace and truth? He sent them a halacha sefer, right? He sent them instructions, right? From here on in, there are going to be days of Purim, and we're going to have Megillah, and we're going to have Shlachmanos, we're going to have Matanos Lev Yonim, you know, we're going to have Seuda. What do you mean, divrei shalom ve'emes? Peace and truth. Wow, you know, okay, sounds like something else. I mean, it doesn't sound like, you know, a description of what you're supposed to do on Purim. What does that mean, divrei shalom ve'emes? So says the Meshech Chachma as follows. The pasuk describes how Purim is supposed to be celebrated bizmanehem, in the respective times. Zmanehem is lashon rabim, it's a plural, right? In the times of Purim. And indeed we find that of all the holidays, Purim has multiple times when you observe it. First of all, there's regular Purim and Shushan Purim, right? So right off the bat, you have different times when different people are observing different things. And more than that, the Mishnah in the beginning of Megillah says that back in the day, when there used to be these outlying villages who couldn't assemble a minyan for Megillah reading, Chazal said that when these villagers come into the city on the market days, on Monday and Thursday, they'd be able to read Megillah early, even though it wasn't yet, not the 14th, not the 15th. They could read Megillah on the 11th, on the 12th, on the 13th, right? There were all different kinds of situations where they could read Megillah earlier. So says the Meshech Chochmah, imagine, you could have people reading Megillah on three different days in any given year. It's Bizmanehem in the various different times of Megillah. Why isn't that a problem of Lo Siskodedu? The Pasuk says that Klal Yisrael is not supposed to break up into different factions. Lo Siskodedu, as Chazal explained, Lo Sasu Agudos Agudos. Don't make different groups. Klal Yisrael is supposed to be united. We're supposed to be engaged in Achdus. Right? We're not... Okay, we sometimes have a problem with that. But I mean, in theory, right, we're supposed to be united. We're not supposed to be doing different kinds of things. What kind of holiday is this? Here, the holiday is legislating that we're all doing different things. You're reading on the 11th, and I'm reading on the 14th, and this guy's reading on the 15th. How does this work? You know, how can a holiday, you know, function where everybody has their own time for observing the holiday? So says the Meshech Chochmah, there's a difference between Purim, you know, which is broken up into these different ways of observing the holiday. This is not a violation of Lo Siskodedu, of making different factions. Making different factions means that we shouldn't have a situation in Klal Yisrael where you have two or more different sides, each claiming, I'm right, my way is correct, your way is wrong. Right? That's, you know, that's terribly disturbing to Achdus, and that's something which can lead to the factionalism of the Jewish people. When it comes to Megillah, the people who were reading on the 11th didn't turn around to the people reading on the 15th and say, we're right, you're wrong, we're 11th people, you're 15th people. You know, we have our Mesorah, you have your Mesorah, we have our Derech, you have your Derech. No, everybody understood that in this context, Chazal set up the holiday with multiple different times, you know, different strokes for different folks, so to speak. You know, they set it up in such a way, milechat chila, that everybody would have a different time to fulfill the mitzvah. So nobody had taimas on one another. Nobody thought that we're right and you're wrong. Everybody understood, we're right for us. You're right for you. So in other words, says the Meshech Chochmah, that's what the Pasuk says, Divrei Shalom ve'emes. Right? These words, these instructions about how to fulfill the mitzvah of Purim and how to read the Megillah in the proper time, Zmanehem, in all the different times, still, Mordechai said, it's Divrei Shalom. Although you're reading the Megillah in different times, everyone gets along. It's words of peace. No one is fighting with one another. And it's MS. It's all true. Nobody thinks we have the MS and you don't have the MS. Nobody thinks we've got it right, you've got it wrong. We all recognize that we're all right. It's MS. It's truth which is agreed upon to all of us, even though we're all doing different things, because the idea that we're doing different things is legislated by Mordechai himself as to what the Jews should do. So Divrei Shalom ve'emes means this is one example where different Jews are doing different things, but everybody's getting along, right? In fact, again, this what I'm about to say, the Meshech Chochmah doesn't say, but maybe you can extend it a little bit. Maybe Mordechai and Esther Bidavka created the holiday of Purim in such a way so that different people would be doing different things as a little bit of a model of how Klal Yisrael should work. That ideally, we should recognize that sometimes there are different mahalchim and different ways of doing things, and within reason, obviously, within certain parameters, it could be that elu ve'elu divrei elokim chayim heim, that, you know, everybody's right in a certain sense. Maybe davka Purim, you know, you ask, why is Purim a holiday that's supposed to stress the achdus, the unity of the Jewish people? Why is it set up in such a way that everybody's doing their own thing? That everybody, so to speak, is making Shabbos for themselves on a different day. You do the 11th, I do the 14th, he does the 15th. Maybe that's Davka supposed to be the message. Right? That we're supposed to walk away from this saying that Achdus can work together with the idea that people, again, within certain limits, everybody follows their Rebbe, their Mesorah, but within certain limits, there can be different ways of doing things within all of Klal Yisrael, and that doesn't challenge the Achdus. You know, if done properly, that actually enhances the Achdus of Klal Yisrael. So Divrei Shalom ve'emes, even though you're doing different things, even though there's Zmanehem, the different times of the Megillah, nonetheless, you know, we should all recognize that idea of Shalom, that we all get along with one another, and emes, no one should think that they have the emes and the other one doesn't. There's a recognition that we're all, you know, working with this idea of truth.
Is it only with the reading of the Megillah that you can do it whenever you want? What about the Suda? What about Mishloach Manot?
Right, so that you find with Yudalit and Tesvav, meaning, you know, those who observe the 15th make Mishloach Manot and Suda on that day, and Yudalit not. With the earlier reading of the Megillah, you know, for the 11th, the 12th, and 13th, that's only the Megillah. Right, the Megillah and Matanos Lev Yonim. The Gemara says that Matanos Lev Yonim goes together with the reading of the Megillah, right? But Mishloach Manos and Seuda, those are postponed for the regular day, you know, for the 14th. Okay. One more.
Still do that? In
no, they don't. We don't do that anymore. It used to be. Right. It used to be in the olden times that the villagers, you know, couldn't get together to have a Megillah, so they'd come in for the market day. I mean, that's just that whole scenario doesn't really exist anymore. Now, just one last fascinating pshat from the Meshech Chochma. So, there's a very famous Medrash of Chazal about Haman casting the lot to make Purim in Adar. Right? It describes how Haman cast the lot, and he was coming up with every month. And every month he said, you know, this is not a good month to start up with the Jewish people. Nisan, they were redeemed, and Sivan, they got the Torah, and, you know, it goes through all the months. So Adar, he finally comes to Adar, and he says, oh, not so bad. Moshe Rabbeinu died in Adar. Okay, so Moshe Rabbeinu died in Adar. That would seem to be a good month to start up with the Jewish people. And the Medrash comments, v'lo yada, he didn't realize, ki ba'adar meis, v'adar nolod. He didn't realize, okay, you know, he should have, you know, read his biographies of Gedolim a little bit more carefully, right? If he would have been a little bit more on the ball, he would have realized that Moshe Rabbeinu died in Adar, but Moshe Rabbeinu was also born in Adar. So the same way that his... the same way that his death in Adar indicates, you know, maybe that it's an inauspicious month, his birth in Adar indicates that it was really quite an auspicious month. And again, at the end of the day, of course, we know that it turns out well for the Jews in Adar. Meshech Chochma gives a fascinating interpretation of how this mistake of Haman actually worked. You know, we know in the Jewish calendar that Hayom Holech Achar Halaylo. In the Jewish calendar, the day starts at night and, you know, concludes during the daytime. The day begins at dark and it concludes, you know, the following evening. But from a non-Jewish point of view, the Gemara mentions in several different places that on the non-Jewish calendar, Halaylo Holech Achar Hayom. You know, the non-Jewish calendar begins at dawn. And every day, you know, concludes at dawn. Of course, in you know, modern-day Western society, we do neither, midnight. Right? In other words, we go from midnight to midnight, right? But classically, the Gemara says the Jews counted the day as beginning at night. The non-Jews counted the day as beginning at dawn, you know, from dawn to dawn, you know, from one morning to the next morning. When exactly was Moshe Rabbeinu born? So the Gemara tells us that when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, the house filled up with light. Nismali habayis kula ora. Meshech Chochma derives from there that he was probably born at night.
At night.
Because otherwise, you know, what does it mean the house was filled up with light? The house was lit anyway. Mm-hmm. So must be he was born the night of Zayin Adar. When did Moshe Rabbeinu pass away? So it says in the Chumash, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, in the midst of this day, in the very middle of the day, he passed away. And Chazal comment, Rashi brings it, that Moshe Rabbeinu ascended Har Nevo, where he eventually died, right in the middle of the day, so that to make the point that no one would be able to stop him. You know, none of Klal Yisrael would be able to hold him back. You know, he didn't sneak out in the middle of the night. He went in broad daylight in the presence of everybody. He died during the day. So says the Meshech Chochma, when Haman cast the lot, Haman was a lamdan, right? When Haman cast the lot, he knew actually when Moshe Rabbeinu was born. He knew that he was born on the night of Zayin Adar. But from Haman's perspective, he said that he wasn't born on Zayin Adar, he was born on Vav Adar, because he was born the night before. So Haman said as follows: oh, Moshe Rabbeinu, was born on one day, and he died the following day. Okay, so then it would appear that he's not such a tremendous tzaddik, or that his schus can't stand up for the Jewish people, because we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu causes tzaddikim to live out their years in full. And again, there's something that comes from Moshe Rabbeinu, the idea that one is born and dies on the same day. There's a certain completion of the cycle. Moshe Rabbeinu fell short. He was born on Vav Adar. He died on Zayin Adar. So in other words, he came a day short, so to speak, of having that sense of completion, right? If anything, he died one day after his birthday, so there was a whole year that had yet to be completed. If anything, it's a sign, the death of Moshe Rabbeinu is a sign that his life was not such a life of tzidkus, of greatness, and can't protect the Jewish people. But Haman didn't realize that from a Jewish perspective, he started counting at night. So really, Moshe Rabbeinu was born on Zayin Adar and died on Zayin Adar, that he did have that special merit of completing his years. Had Haman only realized that that's the way Jews count, had he counted in a Jewish fashion, not in a non-Jewish fashion, he would have realized the tremendous significance of Moshe Rabbeinu's birth and death taking place on the same calendar day, and he would have realized that the month of Adar was just not a month to start up with the Jewish people. Again, a very, very cute way of understanding how the calendar works together with this understanding of the Medrash. We'll pick up, as I said, next week with more about the Megillah and getting ready for Purim. So that, as I said, is next week. And until then, we'll see you then. Yeah.